Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast, a complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 18, May 2nd, 2011. FBI unlocks the vault. Historical records reveal century of snooping, dirty deeds, by Pat Shannon and Victor Thorne. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has placed thousands of pages of its history onto a website it refers to as the Vault and has advised the public to keep a close watch as more will be added. The files contain a treasure trove of new or little-known information about some of the most pivotal events of the 20th century. From A to Z, it has Al Capone to the Zionist Organization of America, with other likely cases one would expect in between, Martin Luther King Jr., John Dillinger, and the Rosenbergs, to the unexpected finds of Kentucky Fried Chicken founder Curlin Harlan Sanders, the beloved Will Rogers, and comedian Jack Benny. Conspicuously missing are files from the Oklahoma City bombing and TWA's downed Flight 800. Evidence has shown the FBI was instrumental in the cover-up of pertinent facts in both of those high-profile cases. In upcoming months, AFP will profile other intriguing gems contained within the FBI's vast database. Some of these stories may broach subjects familiar to AFP and past Spotlight readers, such as the tragic drowning of Teddy Kennedy aide Mary Jo Kopechne. However, additional twists and turns from other sources will reveal elements of these cases that undoubtedly differ from official explanations. Pop culture icons like John Denver are also surprisingly featured in a variety of FBI memos. Denver, well known for folksy songs like Rocky Mountain High, faced an alarming amount of unsubstantiated speculation that reflected the vindictive nature of FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover's bureau. This week's Center Spread provides a focused glimpse of 2,000 documents that some refer to as real-life X-Files. For starters, Pat Shannon analyzes the biggest revelations yet made by the FBI in regard to 1947's celebrated Roswell UFO crash. One agent writes of this event, three so-called flying saucers have been recovered in New Mexico, while another informant described three bodies of human shape that were removed along with the craft. Next, Dave Gahary delves into the strange relationship between two seemingly polar opposites, thuggish JDL hitmen and the violent gangsters who comprise inner-city music. With death threats, extortion, and murder at its core, this story shows the full extent of JDL terrorism in America and how they preyed on equally violent black street musicians. Lastly, the FBI's obsession with anti-war protesters and counterculture figures of the late 1960s and early 70s is addressed. Further, one of the most enigmatic topics in the history of conspiracy research is broached, namely, could secret files be directly linked to the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, the kidnapping of Howard Hughes, and the break-in at Watergate? Page 2, personal from the editor. Globalists in high gear. The internationalists are on the move like never before, evidently terrified that their twisted dream of making the world into one neck to strangle with their debt money system is not yet fully achieved. They are ruthlessly seizing or bombing any nation state that stands in their way. Cases in point are news items on this page about Ivory Coast and Libya. The American and most European governments are nothing more than imbecilic water boys for the international private banking cartel. While some details are not yet known, the emerging picture is that Pentagon strategist Thomas Barnett has been solidly confirmed as correct when, years ago, he stated that the purpose of the modern military in the West is to forcibly integrate nations into the functioning core and that rebel nations against the core were gap nations that had no business being independent, regardless of the merits of their societies. In other words, we are witnessing forced annexation so there can be no sanctuary from the banking military intelligence government combine that says submit or perish. And yet their house of cards rests on just one thing. They have been licensed by the governments to privately issue at horrendous profit the currency and credit of nations, something that nations should do for themselves interest-free. That is the main elite subjugation tool, without which they could not create the vast lines of credit with endless debt attached to fund the war machine. The stakes are so ungodly high and the situation is so scary that the Patriot movement needs to recognize in common the main lever of international power, money creation with compound interest that can swallow the whole world. Take that power away and the dragon can no longer breathe fire. A much greater focus must be attained and maintained to make the world see this and stop it. The powerful of the world sometimes let their masks slip off and you can see their real face more clearly. It's highly unsettling, yet we cannot let this immobilize the movement to defang this global gangsterism. Not acting is not an option. That is why AFP follows the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg meetings, and in a recent development, those who put together Bretton Woods II in New Hampshire. These are the policymakers and trendsetters behind the throne. So we must continue to watch them closely and report their doings to you. Mark Anderson, roving editor. News you may have missed. Bankers behind coup in Ivory Coast? In Ivory Coast, another victim of the New World Order, international bankers will once again be able to collect high interest on their loans made out of nothing. On April 11th, French troops stormed the presidential residence of Laurent Gbagbo and forced him to abdicate. Prior to the 2010 election, Gbagbo had intended to end Ivory Coast's financial servitude to these bankers led by the Rothschild dynasty. That led to the invasion whereby France and the internationalists ousted Gbagbo and reestablished their unofficial colonial rule. The newly installed president, lo and behold, is a banker himself, Alassane Ouattara. Real target, Libyan nationalism. Swiss monetary reformer François de Siebenthal told AFP that Libya's financial system that has long provided regular oil dividends, a stable government currency, and other advantages to the general citizenry was the Allied attack's real target. Moreover, a U.S. Treasury official said Libyan rebels could sell oil in regions they control and sidestep U.S. sanctions if they set up payment systems that do not involve Libya's National Oil Corporation, its public, not private, central bank, nor any other government entity. Vote fraud confirmed. Clint E. Curtis, a noted computer programmer, was asked in court, "Mr. Curtis, are there programs that can be used to secretly fix elections?" "Yes," Curtis bluntly replied. Asked how he knows, he said, "Because in October of 2000, I wrote a prototype for Congressman Tom Feeney at the company I worked for in Oviedo, Florida, that did just that." Then the judge asked, "And when you say you did just that, it would rig an election?" Curtis confirmed, "It would flip the vote 51-49. Whistleblower update. Bowing to pressure from human rights groups, the military agreed to move WikiLeaks whistleblower Bradley Manning out of solitary confinement at the U.S. Marine base in Quantico, Virginia. The former soldier, accused of leaking hundreds of thousands of secret cables from the State Department, as well as U.S. embassies, has reportedly been subjected to physical beatings and humiliation. Manning will be moved to a regular military brig at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Peace and freedom. There are many newsletters published by sanctimonious hypocrites who find it necessary to pander to the forces of global Zionism by proclaiming that Hitler destroyed Germany. One of these individuals is Don McIlvaney, who publishes a newsletter offering investment advice to his readers but strays into false history and propaganda. In one of them, he wrote that the Germans gave up their freedom, security, and prosperity when they elected Hitler and his National Socialists. Following World War I, the German people were severely punished by the criminal Versailles Treaty. They longed for a restoration of their nationalistic pride and for a leader who could fearlessly lead them out of the starvation program deliberately imposed on them by the British, during which 2 million Germans died. The invaders are the ones who disarmed the German people. German prosperity was at its highest in history during the Hitler period. And as for security and protection, the Germans had all they needed until attacked by Britain, which declared war against Germany on September 3, 1939, starting what became World War II. More on daylight savings time, the wrong of spring. Once again, we had to perform the annual rite of spring, running around the house looking for clocks and watches everywhere, anywhere, to set an hour ahead. It's called daylight savings time, DST, whelped by that master of expensive confusion, F.D. Roosevelt. Now, DST hasn't, as far as we know, cost anyone's life, but judging by FDR's record of throwing away 418,500 lives of American men and boys in what became World War II after he and his friends, Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin, maneuvered the U.S. into a useless war, why don't we ashcan the great idea as a distasteful reminder of FDR and let people make their own decisions if they want to get up earlier or work later? And just think, this coming November 6th, we have the happy opportunity of doing it all over again, in reverse. If all this wasted energy could be applied to the national debt, we'd be debt-free in a few weeks. Willis A. Cardo. Page 3, Federal Crime and Corruption. Worst computer hacker in U.S. history reveals he was paid informant for federal government, by Frank Whalen. In 2008, Albert Gonzalez was charged with committing the largest cybercrime in U.S. history. Today, Gonzalez claims the Secret Service, with whom he was working as a paid informant, sanctioned his actions. An examination of the facts seems to validate his claim that he is a scapegoat used to protect far deeper conspiracies. Gonzalez was recruited by the Secret Service in 2003 and officially released from its employ in 2008. He assisted the government in arresting dozens of the world's most wanted cyber criminals. It was also during this time that the pieces of a much larger criminal puzzle came into focus by the Justice Department. According to the New York Times last year, the Justice Department's chief cybercrime prosecutor, Kim Peretti, described in 2005 that she encountered a new cybercrime wave unlike anything ever seen before. The service keeps calling me saying, "We've got another company that contacted us." The volume was getting bigger and bigger, Ms. Peretti said. It is true. Cybercrime is huge business, netting criminals in Asia, Africa, and Eastern Europe hundreds of billions of dollars in stolen money every year. No one is immune from cybercrime either. In 2010, AmericanFreePress.net, the website operated by AFP, was targeted by cybercriminals on two occasions. The second attack was so destructive that it took down the entire website for a week, forcing drastic changes in the way the site is managed. As far as Gonzalez is concerned, the Secret Service worked closely with and was educated by Gonzalez for years. The Times states that Ms. Peretti achieved her position because of Gonzalez. Gonzalez's reported annual salary of $75,000 from the Secret Service seems to validate the U.S. agency's belief in his skills. Mark Rash, a former federal prosecutor, said to Wired in 2010, "It's a significant amount of money to pay an informant, but it's not an outrageous amount if the guy was working full-time and delivering good results." Were those results on behalf of the U.S. government criminal in nature? In an April 8, 2011 Wired report, Gonzalez wrote in a legal motion to withdraw his guilty plea that Secret Service agent Steve Ward once told him, "Go do your thing, just don't get caught." SC Magazine also cited Gonzalez's motion. "The agents had me infiltrating chat rooms, setting people up, and then the agents would bust them. They told me to do what I have to do, just try to not get caught. All the time I was educating the agents as to hacking methods and computer crimes." It seems possible that Gonzalez was following orders by hacking some 170 million credit card files from America's biggest retailers, including the highly publicized TJ Maxx case. Perhaps he was allowed to keep some of the profits while recruiting other hackers to assist him in the acquisition of data, or he was instructed to use the evidence to frame other hackers whom the government was chasing. Maybe the scope of this operation is the only reason Gonzalez hasn't been suicided while in prison. The Times reporter states, "One of the imprisoned hackers told me there were major chains and big hacks that would dwarf TJ Maxx. I'm just waiting for them to indict us for the rest of them." Conceivably, after sitting in jail for a few years, Gonzalez realizes that his former employers intend for him to actually serve his 20-year sentence, and that's why he's now speaking out. With the potential for credit card data theft to be monumentally larger, Gonzalez could have been an unwitting participant in a much bigger plan: worldwide financial collapse. In February 2010, the U.S. government had an exercise called Cyber Shockwave to see how this could manifest. Page 4, AFP on the Global Elite. "Globalists attend bevy of policy meetings," by James P. Tucker, Jr. Trilateral Commission TC luminaries were bouncing like yo-yos during their meeting in Washington, April 8th to 10th, when they met at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. Next, they hopped up the street to an Aspen Institute session on values and diplomacy at the National Cathedral. Then some darted north to the historic Bretton Woods II conference in New Hampshire. Several Aspen Institute leaders also attend trilateral and Bilderberg meetings. Since these sessions happened around the same time, the international elite had to agree on instructions to give the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, IMF, which met in Washington over the weekend of April 16th to April 17th. Henry Kissinger was the biggest yo-yo, giving the same speech at all of these meetings. David Rockefeller, 94, had less bounce. As Rockefeller's valet, Kissinger kept his wheelchair moving briskly. Kissinger, visibly depressed, gave a rationale for the war in Libya that the TC and its brother group, Bilderberg, want to keep rolling, according to an inside source who has proved reliable for years. Both groups want the war extended through 2012 to generate turmoil throughout the Middle East and pressure the United States into attacking Iran on behalf of Israel, which would also produce huge war profits. That it would be the greatest disaster for American policy in history is not important to these meddlers. In informal comments to bystanders before climbing to the podium, Kissinger continued groaning about a, expletive deleted, weekly journal that disclosed the Arab terrorists' role in the Libyan rebellion. But Kissinger Rogers' only concern was that these facts being forced into the national press makes it more difficult to sell the invasion of Libya. After AFP exposed this, the major media picked it up, but for the most part folded it deep into their Libya stories. In all three speeches, Kissinger played the reluctant damsel who was firmly convinced that the United States must put boots on the ground in Libya, among all the wars that the U.S. is already involved in. America should always support democracy and human rights politically, economically, and diplomatically, just as we championed freedom for the captive nations during the Cold War, Kissinger said. But as a general principle, our country should do so militarily only when a national interest is also at stake. He called this position pragmatic realism. So what is America's national interest that is at stake? Libya is an exception to the rule, he explained. While the United States has no vital interest at stake in Libya, Kissinger said, a limited military intervention solely on humanitarian grounds could be justified. Muammar Gaddafi's forces had already caused heavy casualties among civilians, he claimed. But no one will know for sure whether that is even true until the dust settles and independent journalists and researchers can get into Libya to study the situation. Again, posturing as a reluctant warrior, Kissinger, a cook during World War II, said, "Our idealistic goals cannot be the sole motivation for the use of force. We cannot be the world's policeman. We cannot use military force to meet every humanitarian challenge that might arise. Where would we stop? Syria, Yemen, Algeria, or Iran? What about countries that have been strong allies but do not share all our values? Bahrain, Morocco, and Saudi Arabia? What about humanitarian violations in other countries, such as Ivory Coast?" In defiance of facts to justify the U.S. attack, Kissinger reached for the nuclear button. Conduct by Libya may tempt the Iranian regime to speed its development of a nuclear weapon. Rogue states have to remain convinced of our determination to resist nuclear proliferation. So, according to Kissinger, invading Libya prevents Iran from developing nuclear weapons that would threaten Israel. Kissinger was not merely mistaken. He was lying as defined by 8 centuries of Anglo-Saxon common law. It is a lie when one deliberately tells an untruth to enrich himself, injure another, or both. Here's what Kissinger knows. Iran is developing nuclear energy for electrical power. Iran is a member of the International Group of Nations opposing nuclear proliferation and allows its facilities to be inspected. Israel has unofficially had nuclear weapons since the 1960s and refuses to be inspected. This was first revealed by the late George Ball, Undersecretary of State in the JFK administration and a Bilderberg luminary. World Bank President Robert Zoellick, a leader of the Trilateralists and Bilderberg Group, jumped on a food kick, also yo-yoing about the three meetings. He cited a 36% increase in food prices over the past year and called inflation the biggest threat to the poor around the world. "Start with high inflation," Zoellick said. "Mix in price gyrations and then stir in higher fuel costs and you get a toxic brew of real pain contributing to social unrest." His remarks were intended to help pressure Congress into throwing more tax dollars at poor countries. The United States has long been the most generous nation on earth, yet it is routinely taken to the cleaners. Also yo-yoing from the meetings in Washington and Bretton Woods were trilateral Bilderberg luminaries Larry Summers and Paul Volcker. Summers was a key White House economic advisor, and Volcker is a former Fed chairman who recently advised Barack Obama on a special economic paddle until his replacement by General Electric CEO Jeffrey Imelt. Both pushed hard for creating a World Treasury Department under the UN. This long-pending goal of the elite would give the International Monetary Fund power to dictate economic policy to every country on the globe. Dishonor roll, media turncoats. The following news writers and broadcasters attended the 2011 closed-door trilateral commission meeting on a promise to reveal nothing to the public. Jerry Baczynski, Politica, Warsaw. Nicholas Betut, Le Figaro and Les Echos, Paris. Caroline Daniel, Financial Times, London. Marta Dassou, Espana, Rome. Alexis Papahelis, Katamarini, Athens. Ignacio Polanco, El Pais, Madrid. Stefano Silvestri, Commentator, Sole 24 Ora, Rome. Franco Venturini, Corriere della Sera, Rome. David Brooks, New York Times. Lee Cullum, Dallas Morning News. Michael Duffy, Time Magazine. David Gergen, U.S. News & World Report. Donald Graham, Washington Post Chairman. Charlie Rose, PBS host. Jeffrey Simpson, Toronto Globe and Mail. Mortimer Zuckerman, U.S. News & World Report. Yoichi Funabashi, Asahi Shimbun, Tokyo. Sergei Karaganov, Russia and Global Affairs, Moscow. Page 6, We Told You So. AFP Was Right, U.S. Funding Arab Uprisings, by Michael Collins Piper. The New York Times and the Washington Post have finally admitted what American Free Press asserted as far back as February 14th. There is much more to the so-called grassroots revolutions in the Mideast than meets the eye. While critics accuse AFP of purveying conspiracy theories, the Times and the Post have now laid it on the line. American tax dollars have bankrolled a host of both private and quasi-public institutions that have been underwriting the revolutionary activity wreaking havoc throughout the Arab world. The first inkling came in a report buried inside the Post on March 10th under the headline, U.S. Funds Web Firms That Help Mideast Dissidents Skirt Censors. The report read in part, the Obama administration may not be lending arms to dissidents in the Middle East, but it is offering aid in another critical way, helping them to surf the web anonymously as they seek to overthrow their governments. Federal agencies such as the State Department, the Defense Department, and the Broadcasting Board of Governors have been funding a handful of technology firms that allow people to get online without being tracked or to visit news or social media sites that governments have blocked. Many of these little-known companies, such as the Tor Project or UltraReach, are unabashedly supportive of the activists in the Middle East. Federal agencies have funded these companies through grants and contracts. By late spring, the State Department is expected to begin doling out even more money, about $30 million, to technology firms and human rights groups that help and train people to shatter internet security and surf the web without being tracked. On April 15th, the New York Times was even more direct when it reported flat out the fact that the U.S. had been a key behind-the-scenes force in instigating the so-called Arab Spring. Under the headline, U.S. Groups Helped Nurture Arab Uprisings, the report reads in part, even as the United States poured billions of dollars into foreign military programs and anti-terrorism campaigns, a small core of American government-financed organizations were promoting democracy in authoritarian Arab states. The money spent on these programs was minute compared with efforts led by the Pentagon. But as American officials and others look back at the uprisings of the Arab Spring, they are seeing that the United States' democracy-building campaigns played a bigger role in fomenting protests than was previously known, with key leaders of the movements having been trained by the Americans in campaigning, organizing through new media tools, and monitoring elections. A number of the groups and individuals directly involved in the revolts and reforms sweeping the region received training and financing from groups like the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute, and Freedom House, a nonprofit human rights organization based in Washington. The Republican and Democratic Institutes are loosely affiliated with the Republican and Democratic parties. They were created by Congress and are financed through the National Endowment for Democracy, which was set up in 1983 to channel grants for promoting democracy in developing nations. The National Endowment receives about $100 million annually from Congress. Freedom House also gets the bulk of its money from the American government, mainly from the State Department. With the truth of U.S. involvement in the orchestrated revolutions now being steadily unveiled, April 18th, the Washington Post stated in the headline of a front-page lead story that U.S. secretly backed Syrian opposition groups, cables released by WikiLeaks show. The Post story elaborated, the State Department has secretly financed Syrian political opposition groups and related projects, including a satellite TV channel that beams anti-government programming into the country, according to previously undisclosed diplomatic cables. The London-based satellite channel, Barada TV, began broadcasting in April 2009, but has ramped up operations to cover the mass protests in Syria as part of a long-standing campaign to overthrow the country's autocratic leader, Bashar al-Assad. Barada TV is closely affiliated with the Movement for Justice and Development, a London-based network of Syrian exiles. Classified U.S. diplomatic cables show that the State Department has funneled as much as $6 million to the group since 2006 to operate the satellite channel and finance other activities inside Syria. The U.S. money for Syrian opposition figures began flowing under President George W. Bush after he effectively froze political ties with Damascus in 2005. The financial backing has continued under President Obama, even as his administration sought to rebuild relations with Assad. The U.S.-sponsored revolutions, in many respects, validate AFP's notation on February 14th that the World Zionist Organization's Israeli-based magazine, Kuvanim, as far back as 1982, had outlined a geopolitical strategy to disrupt and balkanize the Arab world, dividing the Arab states from within. That Israel's oft-touted closest ally, the United States, has been found to now be implementing the agenda is to be expected. One particularly influential hardline American supporter supporter of Israel, former Senator Norm Coleman, Republican Minnesota, explained in a February 24th commentary in the Washington Times that supporting what was described as democratic turmoil was worth the risk for the United States. After all, Coleman said, if extremists should happen to come to power in any of the nations where the U.S. had helped instigate revolutions, the United States must prepare to confront their aggressive plans with stalwart resistance. In case you didn't figure that out, Coleman meant military intervention. That's right, more war. Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. Ohio's Kucinich blasts White House for meddling in affairs of nations. Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat, Ohio, recently blasted the White House for secretly meddling in the affairs of foreign countries, especially in Asia and the Middle East, where the United States is fighting at least three wars. When multiple reports came out detailing the level of intervention the United States had in the so-called Arab Spring revolutions, you would think it would come as a shock, said Kucinich. It wasn't. It's increasingly clear just how far our country has waded into the affairs of others with a policy of intervention, war, and preemption. Kucinich added that Washington has no business sticking its nose into the affairs of other countries. The United States has no right to interfere in the international affairs of any other nation, just as no other nation has the right to interfere in the internal affairs of the United States, he said. Kucinich was responding to news reports that the White House was actively sponsoring demonstrations in countries like Syria, while at the same time negotiating with Syrian government officials. The United States was financing the political opposition in Syria at the same time that the administration was pursuing a policy of engagement with the Syrian government, said Kucinich. However, he added, no one in Congress seemed to care about the fact that the U.S. government's hypocrisy was exposed. Is it any surprise, then, that many people around the world now view the United States government as duplicitous and scheming? If we don't have integrity in our dealings with other countries, Kucinich said, there is no reason for anyone to believe anything the U.S. government will say. Reforms in Syria and other countries may be necessary, but must come from within. Outside interference runs the risk of precipitating violence, inviting retaliation, and even more violence. While this policy does nothing for the American people, it does benefit the weapon makers who make billions of dollars arming both the governments of foreign countries as well as the rebel forces that are battling them. Most importantly, said Kucinich, our destructive and inconsistent foreign policy is contributing to a war of all against all. Furious backpedaling on the debt ceiling taking place in D.C. The good news is Congress started its Easter vacation on April 18th and will not return until April 29th. The bad news is, with the national debt fast approaching the legal limit known as the debt ceiling, Democrats who once opposed increasing the country's debt are now backpedaling as fast as they can. A king of the debt flip-floppers, House Minority Whip Representative Steny Hoyer, a Democrat, Maryland, recently told reporters, I have voted against the debt limit in the past. That was a mistake. Was it a mistake or a tactic that suited him at the time? Whatever happened to principle? Keeping the ceiling in place is just common sense, regardless of party affiliation. And to help do that, Congress could just stop the ongoing foreign wars. Hoyer seems to have forgotten his own poignant words in 2004 when he voted against a Republican measure to raise the debt ceiling, to wit, it is ironic that Republicans' first major action after an election in which they touted their strong sense of morality will be one of immense immorality. Republicans' irresponsible policies have left them no choice but to raise the limit on the amount of debt America can incur. But there is a choice in how it is raised. Congress must tie raising the debt limit to a realistic, workable plan to put America back on a path to fiscal security. A first step would be to implement the tried-and-true pay-as-you-go policies, which reined in debt in the 1990s and produced the record budget surpluses President Bush inherited from his Democratic predecessor. If Republicans do not put in place these responsible policies, they will immorally saddle our children with trillions of dollars of debt that will hinder their ability to invest in their own security and success. Stink bugs costing U.S. farmers millions. They came from China in the 90s, most likely hitching a free ride on shipping crates that had been loaded onto cargo ships. After first being identified by entomologists in Allentown, Pennsylvania, these nasty Asian insects called brown marmorated stink bugs, for the noxious odor they emit when squashed, have now spread across the country, destroying crops and irritating homeowners in 33 out of the 50 states in the Union. Marmorated means resembling marble. They have no natural enemy in America. To most people, the bugs are just a nuisance, but to farmers they cost big bucks. Last year, according to reports, stink bugs cost apple growers on the East Coast an estimated $37 million in damages. A spokesman for the U.S. Apple Association told a Washington Daily newspaper that stink bugs are the most serious invasive pest threat to U.S. agriculture in a generation. Stink bugs join the emerald ash borer on the list of Asian imports that are wreaking havoc on agriculture and our forests. Unlike many pests, stink bugs are indiscriminate in the types of crops they target, including apples, peaches, pears, corn, soybeans, tomatoes, and grapes. They are also resistant to many pesticides as well as organic means typically used to fight pests. At a recent town hall meeting in Maryland called to address farmers' concerns about the bugs, Representative Roscoe Bartlett, Democrat Maryland, said, "We were in a big building and I looked down at my name tag in front of me on the table and there was a stink bug crawling on it." In an effort to strike back, Bartlett has initiated an invasive species caucus along with Representative Todd Russell Platt, Republican Pennsylvania. The two legislators say they will be involved inviting Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and other members of Congress to see the stink bugs in action so that they can appropriate funds to study ways to control them. Page 10, Government Secrets Revealed. Thousands of once-secret FBI documents reveal a century of dirty deeds. In early April, the Federal Bureau of Investigation launched a new website it called The Vault, where thousands of pages of official documents revealing details concerning hundreds of since-closed federal investigations could be perused by anyone with internet access. The online reading room hosts an incredibly broad range of issues on such topics as FBI investigations into the World War II-era Tokyo Rose espionage case and German rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, to more modern subjects like the Ruby Ridge incident and Waco's David Koresh. And while much of the material remains redacted, that is, blacked out for national security reasons, even a cursory reading of some of the files reveals a century's worth of federal law enforcement spying on those Americans who buck the establishment. Over the course of the next several issues, American Free Press editors and journalists will be featuring many of these once-secret FBI files so that all Americans can see for themselves what Washington elites have been doing with the unlimited power they have been handed. Shocking Inside Info Uncloaked by Victor Thorne. To say that J. Edgar Hoover's FBI exhibited an obsessive interest in anti-war activists and peace protesters is an obvious understatement. In the recently opened FBI vault, one finds an array of intriguing and eclectic documents. For instance, it is apparent that the Nixon administration was horrified that ex-Beatle John Lennon, along with Chicago 7 defendants Jerry Rubin, Bobby Seale, and Rennie Davis, would stage nationwide music rallies that would culminate in a massive protest at the 1972 Republican National Convention in Miami. At each stop along the way, youth would be encouraged to register for the upcoming election so that Nixon would be defeated. To thwart Lennon, the FBI vault indicates that the musician's files had been charged out to the Immigration and Naturalization Service in order to deport him from the country. The Nixon regime's fears can be seen in a passage where Lennon is said to have contributed $75,000 to the Election Year Strategy Information Center to assist this group in organizing activities during the coming year that would culminate in demonstrations at the RNC in August 1972. Anti-war activists aren't the only ones that posed a threat inside Nixon's mind. Even innocuous groups such as clergymen and laity were viewed as suspicious. After a reverend was arrested for participating in a 1972 protest in Chicago, where five automobiles blocked traffic on the Eisenhower Expressway, a file was opened. Similarly, when churches presented slideshows questioning the Vietnam War, they were promptly labeled anti-administration and anti-American. Seriously dangerous individuals were also chronicled deep within the vault, such as terrorist William Ayers, later Barack Obama's ghostwriter and early political supporter. An FBI informant, Larry Grathwall, related how, after infiltrating the Weather Underground, Ayers described what would happen to diehard capitalists that refused to accept communism. Ayers insisted that up to 25 million Americans would be carted off to re-education centers before being eliminated. If readers are interested in material of a lighter variety, the FBI also took notice of Elvis Presley's quirky December 21, 1970 visit to the White House, where he met with an obviously uncomfortable Nixon. Unbeknownst to Nixon, Elvis packed two handguns that day, one for his own protection and the other as a gift for the commander-in-chief. Elvis confided to Nixon that the Smothers Brothers and Jane Fonda should be forced to pay for their corruption of America's youth. Ironically, Nixon presented Presley with a badge from the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Examples of ineptitude also surface in the vault, specifically regarding the chaotic 1969 Helter Skelter slayings. In a file dedicated to Charles Manson, law enforcement incompetence becomes apparent. A six-man team of police detectives today probed two macabre murder cases with some startling similarities. Senseless, savage stabbings with almost ritualistic overtones. Police maintain there was no direct physical evidence to connect the stabbing deaths of a middle-aged couple and the mass murder of actress Sharon Tate. How they could have ignored bloody messages in each residence is mind-boggling. Even archives directly incriminating the FBI's own lurk among these heavily redacted documents. A case in point is Terry Norman, an FBI informant and agent provocateur prior to the Kent State killings. Although recent revelations prove that direct orders to shoot were given to Ohio National Guardsmen only moments before shots rang out, it's now believed that Norman may have fired four shots from a .38 caliber pistol during a staged altercation with the protesters. Memo on Mysterious Roswell Crash Turns Up in Released Files by Pat Shannon. Ever since Mac Brassel heard the crash on his New Mexico ranch on July 2, 1947, later discovering the flying saucer debris, and the local mortician telling of the weird little bodies that were hastily placed in child caskets and buried in a secret location, the U.S. government's official stand on the subject of unidentified flying objects has been strangely reticent, taking neither a yay nor nay stand. However, from the files of the FBI vault, a 1950 letter has surfaced from Washington Bureau's Special Agent in Charge, Guy Hoddle, reporting another agent's interview with U.S. Air Force personnel, presumably at Roswell Air Force Base. Hoddle's report confirmed what the government never has before. An investigator for the Air Force stated that three so-called flying saucers had been recovered in New Mexico. They were described as being circular in shape with raised centers approximately 50 feet in diameter. Each one was occupied by three bodies of human shape but only 3 feet tall, dressed in metallic cloth of very fine texture. Each body was bandaged in a manner similar to the blackout suits used by speed flyers and test pilots. According to Mr. Name redacted, informant, the saucers were found in New Mexico due to the fact that the government has a very high-powered radar set up in that area, and it is believed the radar interferes with the controlling mechanism of the saucers. No further evaluation was attempted by S.A., name redacted, concerning the above. The document confirms that both Washington and the military have long been aware of the details relating to the incident, but have continued for well over a half century to keep it from public view. A further file did claim the crafts were actually weather balloons. FBI, JDL Terrorists Threaten to Kill Black Musicians by Dave Gahary. Newly released files from a Federal Bureau of Investigation report on the 1996 murder of black musician Tupac Shakur reveal he had received death threats from the Jewish Defense League, JDL. Although the FBI didn't make any direct connection between the unsolved murder of the music star and the JDL, the case has all the markings of a shakedown gone awry. According to the report released due to a Freedom of Information Act FOIA request that involved other black musicians, the scheme involves subjects making telephonic death threats to the music star. Subjects then intercede by contacting the victim and offering protection for a fee. The 102-page probe, which ran from October 1996 to May 1999, continued. The victim and their family are taken to a safe haven, usually a private estate, and are protected by gun-toting bodyguards associated with the JDL. The subjects convince the victim they have worked a deal out with the persons making the death threats, and the threats cease. The victim then pays the subjects for the protection services rendered and resumes their normal lifestyle with no fear of further death threats. The monetary amount being extorted is in the $50,000 range. The JDL, whose tagline is Never Again, has been an active terrorist organization classified as such by the FBI on United States soil since its founding in 1968 by arch-Zionist terrorist and FBI informant Rabbi Martin Meir Kahan, an Egyptian-born American ostensibly gunned down Kahan in November 1990 following a speech given to Orthodox Jews. According to an FBI report on terrorist groups, bombing is the JDL's favorite tactic, accounting for 78% of all JDL incidents. Shootings are next, accounting for 16%, followed by arson, vandalism, and kidnapping. Three of the JDL's most notorious acts were, one, the bombing and murder of American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee regional director Alex O'Day in 1985 after his appearance on the television show Nightline, two, Dr. Baruch Goldstein's 1994 slaughter of 29 Palestinian Muslims kneeling in prayer, and three, a plot to bomb the office of Lebanese-American Representative Daryl Issa, Republican California, in 2001. Issa's net worth is in the range of $250 million, Congress's wealthiest member. After praying Palestinians were slaughtered in the West Bank city of Hebron, the JDL wrote, "We are not ashamed to say that Goldstein was a charter member of the Jewish Defense League. For a group that is even criticized by the Anti-Defamation League and Southern Poverty Law Center, the extortion and murder of a few black music stars seems like child's play for these Jewish terrorists." Gemstone file referenced in FBI Vault by Victor Thorne. On June 9, 1972, Special Assistant to the President Jeb Magruder was said to have presented illegally obtained wiretap logs from G. Gordon Liddy to Attorney General John Mitchell. The codename for these documents was the Gemstone File. 8 days later, the infamous plumbers were busted at the Watergate Hotel while attempting to break into Democratic National Committee headquarters. The next morning, Liddy came forward to say that the burglars had ties to the White House and the committee to re-elect the president. In the realm of conspiracy theory, the Gemstone files have an even deeper meaning. Compiled by a mysterious figure named Bruce Roberts, this collection of mimeographed copies became an underground classic. Roberts, in fantastic fashion, connected Aristotle Onassis, the Kennedy family, and Meyer Lansky, among many others, to bootlegging, heroin trafficking, and the deepest of intrigue and subterfuge. Next to enter the picture was Howard Hughes, who launched Nixon's political career via a shadowy loan to his brother Donald. Interestingly, in H.R. Haldeman's biography, he claimed that whenever Nixon used the code words "the Bay of Pigs thing," he was actually referring to JFK's assassination. According to the Gemstone file, Onassis made room for Nixon to ultimately win the 1968 election by eliminating Bobby Kennedy. To bring this scenario full circle, CIA spook E. Howard Hunt and Liddy were acquaintances of Roberts. Moreover, to remove incriminating information the Democrats supposedly had on Nixon's connections to Onassis, they planned the infamous Watergate break-in. Some claim the Gemstone files are a wild hoax, but with at least a mention of them in the FBI's vault, some semblance of credibility now exists. FBI's candid admissions about Weaver murders. In a remarkably unusual moment of candor, FBI Director Louis Free admits to Senate hearings in 1995 that the scene at the Idaho Mountain home of the Randy Weaver family has become synonymous with tragedy, and that everything was a series of terribly flawed law enforcement operations with tragic consequences. Of course, that is no consolation to the Weaver family. After Randy Weaver's 14-year-old son Sammy and his wife Vicky were murdered by federal law enforcement agents. Page 12, AFP on false flag terrorism. Brits level trumped-up charges against man who exposed false flags in London, by Mark Anderson. After fending off extradition from Ireland for almost 2 years, British national John Anthony Hill was arrested in February 2009 and transferred back to Great Britain, where he is now facing trial for having submitted to British authorities several copies of his video documentary, debunking the official story on the deadly July 7, 2005 London subway and city bombings. The 57-minute documentary titled 7-7 Ripple Effect, which was reviewed by this writer on April 17th, shows detailed evidence of an inside job. It was first released on November 5, 2007. "I've got them banged to rights," Hill told AFP. He means that the documentary has Britain's government cornered, since it leaves so little room for doubt that the event was a false flag attack. For just sending his video to the British court to expose the inside cabal that instigated the bombings, Hill is the one going to trial. He is charged with attempting to pervert the course of justice contrary to the common law, in legal language. According to Hill, what started as a mock drill widely publicized on the BBC in 2004 was manipulated into a real terror event that killed 52 innocent people in a scenario that was a carbon copy of what was passed off as a drill. Ultimately, it was about Prime Minister Tony Blair needing a crisis to keep Britain involved in President George W. Bush's war on terror, Hill said. The Tavistock Square bus blast killed 14 people, while three separate subway blasts killed 7, 8, and 27 people, respectively. The British government claims the culprits, four backpack-carrying terrorists who were British citizens of foreign extraction, died in the attack. But solid evidence shows the four backpackers never made it to those trains nor the correct bus, so the real count from the attacks remain at 52. The blast pattern in the train cars shows the force came from under the floors from powerful charges professionally attached to the undercarriages of the trains. The Israeli government and Israeli companies are strongly implicated in the London bombing plot, as is British MI5 intelligence, the BBC, and other entities. Hill's film, created with the help of two colleagues, also presents official Thameslink train records that prove that the accused bombers could not have been on the trains that exploded. They, the British government, had to fake it, including altering a surveillance photo, because three of the actors missed the tube trains they were supposed to catch and which blew up without them being on board, Hill narrated. The film reveals that the BBC television show Panorama on May 16, 2004, broadcast a panel discussion wherein various well-connected officials, including a highly notable figure, Peter Power of Visor Consultants, announced an emergency exercise that assumed a scenario virtually identical to the real bombing that later happened. The CCTV surveillance cameras in the subway system, operated by an Israeli company, Verint Systems, stopped working, but only in the four bombed areas, just before the blasts. Bus company employees have stated that couldn't happen, Hill told AFP. And near the Luton train depot, an Israeli security firm, ICTS, appears to be where the Muslim actors receive their final instructions, carrying out what their British instructors told them was a disciplined but harmless exercise to help prevent terrorism. When it became clear the drill was a cover for the real thing, three of the four patsies fled and evidently were shot dead by British authorities at Canary Wharf. The fate of the fourth, Hasib Hussein, is unknown, but probably he was also rubbed out. Upon silencing the original four, while the British nation was told they all died as suicide bombers, the government brought forth three other names, Mohammed Shakil, Sadir Salim, and Wahid Ali, saying they were involved. These three were put on trial in May 2008 when my video had been in the public domain for 6 months, Hill said. The prosecution and the judge were both misleading the jury and lying to them. The jury cannot reach a verdict. But before the trio's second trial, the authorities arrested Hill. The three alleged accomplices spent 2 years in prison but were found not guilty, unanimously, Hill said. They were released. Page 13, AFP on false flag terrorism. India claims CIA involved in terror attacks, by Richard Walker. An American and a Canadian guilty of plotting the November 2008 massacre in Mumbai, India, will tell a Chicago court on May 18th conflicting stories about who hired them to do it, thereby ensuring the true masterminds likely will never be brought to justice, AFP has learned. The contradicting claims will form the backdrop of a trial with an explosive storyline sure to further damage Washington's image around the world. The attack, which drew widespread condemnation, began in India on November 26, 2008, and lasted until November 29, killing 164 people and wounding at least 308. The event is often called 26/11. In a move sure to inflame tensions between India and Pakistan, the Canadian will tell the court that the Pakistani government and its intelligence agency, the ISI, or Inter-Services Intelligence, were the masterminds of the attack. The CIA and Mossad work closely with the ISI, which provides information on groups such as the Taliban fighting U.S. troops in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The American, who has taken a plea deal in exchange for his testimony, will say the real terror bosses were leaders of the Pakistani revolutionary group Lashkar-e-Taiba, also known as LET. Its name translated means Army of the Pure. So, who are these two North American terrorists whose crime of mass murder has been generally ignored by America's mainstream media? One is David Coleman Headley, a.k.a. Daoud Gilani, born in Washington State in 1960 to a Pakistani father and an American mother. After his parents divorced, he moved with his father to Pakistan and was raised a strict Muslim. In his teens, he attended a preparatory college run by Pakistan's military but rebelled. He flew to Philadelphia in 1977 to stay with his mother. Headley attended Philadelphia Community College but abandoned his studies to become a courier for a Pakistani drug cartel, operating in and out of the United States. Over the following decade, he masqueraded as a businessman, living in Chicago with his wife and two children until the DEA caught him smuggling heroin through New York in 1997. He got a reduced sentence of 15 months in return for becoming an informant and was sent to Pakistan as part of a DEA undercover operation. This is where his story becomes complicated. According to Headley, he worked for the DEA for years, traveling back and forth to Chicago from Pakistan. Then, at a time he has yet to identify, he supposedly worked with LET and became a terrorist. Indian intelligence experts think the story stinks. They believe the CIA took over the task of running him sometime after the World Trade Center attacks. India says Langley, CIA, had to know he was a DEA asset with links to Pakistan's military from his teenage days, as well as to the ISI. Therefore, if anyone was capable of infiltrating LET, it was Headley. The CIA claims it never knew him, and the ISI denies it had any dealings with him. The FBI claims that he occasionally returned to Chicago in the years he was a terrorist and worked for a bogus company, First World Immigration Service, owned by Tahawar Hussain Rana, a friend from his boyhood years in Pakistan. Rana, who became a Canadian citizen in 2001, will go on trial in Chicago on May 18th. The two men have admitted they used the immigration company to cover up their terror activities. When they traveled abroad, they passed themselves off as regular businessmen with the help of their Canadian and American passports. Another important question is, who told Headley to masquerade as an American Jew while doing surveillance work in Mumbai and other Indian cities? In a strange twist, which will not be revealed in Rana's trial, the lawyer for a Mumbai terrorist held by India has filed a motion on behalf of his client, claiming Headley was one of several foreign interrogators who questioned his client after he was arrested. According to the lawyer, his client was interrogated and threatened by a Colonel Headley, but it was not until David Headley was arrested in the United States it became clear the two Headleys are the same person. Headley's plea deal means he will serve a life sentence, but Rana's fate is uncertain. His lawyers hope to mitigate his role by claiming a public authority defense that he acted under the authority, actual or apparent, of the Pakistani government and the ISI. Page 14. AFP on Japan. Physicist says Japan's recent disasters might be impossible to recover from, by Victor Thorne. Heralded in the 1980s as the next rising economic superpower, Japan now faces a dystopian future that threatens her very existence. During an April 13th interview, physicist John DiNardo told this writer, "Japan is so toxic with radioactive fallout all the way to Tokyo that people are being told not to drink the water. The March 11th earthquake and tsunami were the greatest disaster this world has ever seen. Japan may not have long to live." In all fairness, scores of scientists are downplaying the Fukushima reactor's health dangers despite its crisis level being raised to 7 for only the second time in history. The first level 7, of course, occurred after the Chernobyl meltdown in 1986. On April 4th, cleanup workers at Fukushima pumped 22 million pounds of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Worse, another 120 million pounds of contaminated water is still yet to be removed. As exposed fuel rods continue to spew high levels of radiation, Hidehiko Nishiyama, Deputy Director General of Japan's Nuclear Safety Agency, confessed that once toxic water is removed from the lethal reactors, we do not have a plan beyond that. The stress of being in so far over their heads has affected Tokyo Electric Power Company President Masataka Shimizu, who suffered a nervous breakdown that hospitalized him for 8 days. Regrettably, it will be months before Fukushima's reactors cool enough to be enshrouded by concrete. Meanwhile, industrial machine executive Gerald Karch explained the magnitude of this undertaking to Josie Cox of Reuters on April 14th. In Chernobyl, where a single reactor was encased, 11 trucks were in action for a number of months. In Fukushima, we're talking about 4 reactors. Hitachi spokesman Masano Sato stated that the entire cleanup could potentially take nearly 30 years. Suspiciously, 2 of the firms slated to assist in the process are major Obama donors, GE and Exelon, while a third, Bechtel, has long-standing ties to the Bush crime family. To make matters worse, nearly 1,000 aftershocks have rocked the island of Honshu, causing many residents to flee Tokyo or even Japan itself. Journalist Tim Horniak wrote about the continued aftershocks on April 13th. Some say dots on the map are getting closer to the capital and that the big one will hit right under Tokyo Bay. Closer to Fukushima's danger zone, entire ghost cities sit silently as if frozen in an eerie Twilight Zone time warp. In the once thriving metropolis of Minami-Soma, children's toys lie on sidewalks, apartment doors swing open and shut, and abandoned cars sit idly along roadways. Sadly, packs of barking dogs search for their owners or errant scraps of food. Still, due to a lack of roadblocks and security measures, a few residents have violated orders to vacate the radiation-plagued areas. For survival, these refugees pull tainted seaweed from shorelines or vegetables that health ministers have warned them not to eat. This disaster has even created a class of leper-like untouchables called hibakushas, who are quarantined from homeless shelters due to being radiation contaminated. Previously, this same ostracism was meted out to survivors after atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Although the mainstream media is underplaying these horror stories, DiNardo stressed to AFP that everyone globally should be concerned. Jet streams act like a blowing fan, therefore carrying increased radioactive fallout across Europe and toward the U.S. It's being diffused throughout the entire world. Page 15, Behind the Scenes with Michael Collins Piper. A Holocaust of Justice, Neil Schur and the OSI by Michael Collins Piper. All new revelations of corruption by the Justice Department's Nazi-hunting Office of Special Investigations, OSI, in the effort to falsely implicate a 90-year-old Ukraine-born Cleveland man, John Demjanjuk, as a Nazi war criminal are no surprise to anyone familiar with the record of the OSI's longtime director, Neil Schur, who led the conspiracy against Demjanjuk, a malicious campaign that goes back some 30 years. In AFP's April 25th edition, former Representative Jim Traffican, Democrat, Ohio, noted in his column that a recently declassified long secret FBI report from 1985 revealed the FBI had concluded the so-called proof that Demjanjuk was a World War II guard at the German-run Sobibor work camp in Poland. What was purported to be an official German-issued identification card had been, in the FBI's judgment, quite likely fabricated by the Soviet Union. Although Schur and the OSI knew the FBI considered the document a forgery, they withheld this from Demjanjuk's defense at the time Demjanjuk was first being accused of being a war criminal and sent to Israel, where he was tried and convicted on war crimes charges and sentenced to hang. Had it not been for the singular efforts of Trafficant, then in Congress, Demjanjuk would have died on the gallows. However, Trafficant stepped forward, the lone member of Congress to do so, and launched an honest, unbiased investigation. He brought forth evidence that a key OSI witness had committed perjury with the knowledge of the OSI in claiming Demjanjuk was a guard at the Treblinka work camp in Poland, and proved that it was another individual altogether. As a consequence, the Israeli Supreme Court reversed Demjanjuk's conviction, allowing Trafficant to bring Demjanjuk home to freedom. More recently, however, the OSI, refusing to accept defeat, again went after Demjanjuk, now claiming he had been a guard at Sobibor. Demjanjuk was again deported and has been on trial in Germany on the basis of the Soviet fraud placing him as a guard at Sobibor. Amazingly, however, the German court rejected appeals by Demjanjuk's attorney that the trial be suspended until further investigation of the OSI's culpability in fabricating evidence against his client. In light of all this, the record of Schur, the OSI director who masterminded the persecution of Demjanjuk, is revealing. In the summer of 2002, Schur was forced out as chief of staff in the D.C. office of the International Commission on Holocaust-Era Insurance Claims, ICHEIC. Schur was caught taking unauthorized reimbursements on his extravagant worldwide travel expenses for the ICHEIC. In other words, he was an embezzler. A longtime hero of the Jewish community and a widely promoted media star, Schur was effectively stealing from self-described Holocaust survivors and their heirs. A leading force in what has been called the Holocaust industry, the ICHEIC was established jointly by a variety of European insurance companies, Holocaust survivor groups, top Jewish organizations, and the Israeli government to sort out claims by Holocaust survivors who allege that insurance companies refused to pay their families' insurance policies. Although Schur's resignation was announced on June 20, 2002, it was not known until late in the year that he had been the subject of a secretive corruption investigation carried out at the direction of former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, the well-paid ICHEIC chairman. The Schur scandal was considered so sensitive to Jewish public relations concerns that Eagleburger asked William Webster, former director of the FBI and the CIA, to convene a high-level review of the secret internal investigation that led to Schur's forced resignation. Because of his ties to the Justice Department and his long-standing services to the Jewish community, Schur did not face charges and go to prison despite having confessed to misappropriating ICHEIC funds. Schur is said to have reimbursed the Holocaust outfit for the stolen funds. His longtime secretary at the OSI hung up when AFP called in 2002 to ask if the OSI would be investigating misuse of OSI funds by Schur during his tenure there. For 11 years until his departure in 1994, Schur had been director of the OSI. After leaving the OSI, Schur went on to serve as executive director of AIPAC, the powerful Israeli lobby that listed Trafficant as its number one target. ultimately a clique of Justice Department lawyers using sure-style tactics concocted a trumped-up corruption case against Traficant and sent the populist congressman to prison. Under Schur's direction, the OSI was implicated in other corruption. The late former U.S. Attorney General Elliot Richardson, while serving as attorney for the Inslaw Corporation, discovered OSI was responsible for the theft of surveillance software known as Promise, which Inslaw was under contract to provide the Justice Department. However, the OSI conspirators stole the software and turned it over to Israel's intelligence service, Mossad. Richardson also charged that Schur's OSI operated a covert operations unit inside the Justice Department, involved in assassinations and other acts designed to silence American political dissidents. The exposure of Schur's pilfering lent credence to the charge by many that the Holocaust has essentially become a racket, a point driven home by American Jewish professor Norman G. Finkelstein in his book, The Holocaust Industry: Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. Ironically, Finkelstein was denied academic tenure for writing that book because he raised questions about the ICHEIC and its profiteering administrators, a contention proven by Schur's exposure as an embezzler. At the time the Inslaw scandal was erupting, the Spotlight newspaper led the media in publicizing the affair. A Justice Department attorney promoted to a federal judgeship in return for his services on behalf of the OSI thieves, S. Martin Thiel, issued a ruling that liquidated the Spotlight in 2001 after it was forced into bankruptcy. That all came about as a result of a conspiracy orchestrated by Andrew Allen, a San Francisco millionaire with family ties to the New York Jewish Our Crowd elite, who had bragged under oath that he was involved in intelligence operations in Afghanistan and Burma, known to be under the direction of both the CIA and Israel's Mossad. Sobibor, Holocaust Propaganda and Reality, softcover, 445 pages, illustrated, $25 plus $5 shipping and handling. Available from TBR Book Club, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C., 20003. The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering by Norman Finkelstein. Softcover, 150 pages, $16 plus $5 shipping and handling. Available from TBR Book Club, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C., 20003. Or call TBR toll-free 1-877-773-9077 to charge to a major credit card. Page 17, AFP Book Review. Reviewer believes Assassins is Thorne's best book, by Dave Gahary. Victor Thorne's latest book, New World Order Assassins, is perhaps his best. In fact, before I was halfway through it, I remember remarking, "This is the real people's history of the United States." Thorne details scores of hidden facts in his analysis of high-profile killings of the 20th century, specifically those between 1962 and 1999, in this, the final installment of his NWO trilogy. In his role as investigative reporter, Thorne proves, in this reviewer's opinion, through 16 chapters and 264 pages, that what we think we know is wrong. One conclusion is inescapable. None of the murders profiled in Thorne's book played out in the ways we were taught, but instead, they were orchestrated by the power elite, a New World Order hit squad, if you will. Thorne tackles the most notorious murders of our time, beginning with the silencing of Hollywood's platinum blonde star Marilyn Monroe, and ending with the mass murder at Columbine High School. When Thorne tells us in Chapter 1, Presidential Model, the murder of Marilyn Monroe, that within hours of her murder, Rat Pack actor Peter Lawford, who was married to JFK's sister, placed a frantic call at 6 a.m. to President Kennedy at the White House that lasted for 20 minutes, and that this conversation has remained hidden due to national security concerns ever since, readers begin their fascinating ride through Thorne's rabbit hole. As one of the country's top conspiracy researchers, Thorne masterfully details how Monroe could never have been allowed to survive past that fateful weekend in August 1962, as she planned on calling a press conference on Monday morning to blow the lid off the whole damn thing, referring, of course, to secrets of the Kennedy White House to which she was privy. Scores of other hidden facts in this chapter alone leave the reader with at least two undeniable undeniable conclusions. Marilyn did not overdose on drugs, but was murdered to protect the philandering JFK and RFK. Secondly, the corporate mainstream media was, and still is, actively involved in this cover-up. Utilizing his encyclopedic knowledge, Thorne writes with the ease of a researcher who has been immersed in this esoteric genre for over 20 years. Each chapter incorporates scores of suppressed facts that allow readers to easily identify common threads running through all. Thorne also provides a glossary of terms that illuminate similarities and patterns that touch all of these murders, i.e. the tools of the trade of these secret death squads. This glossary includes arrests shortly before the event, lurkers, the same murky faces in the shadows from the Bay of Pigs to the September 11, 2001 events, and mind control techniques like hypnosis and brainwashing performed on patsies. Through this glossary, Thorne introduces an entirely new way of viewing these important events, while at the same time making a mockery of the prepackaged, censored news spewed from a corrupt corporate media. On each significant event involving Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Sirhan Sirhan, John Lennon, Princess Diana, Son of Sam, and many others, Thorne proves that everything we know is wrong. Particularly disturbing is Thorne's chapter on Charles Manson, in which he puts his thesis to work. These New World Order murderers will do anything to keep the power elite propped up and their war machine humming. New World Order Assassins. $30 plus $5 shipping and handling. Softcover, 264 pages. Is available only from AFP. Send payment to AFP, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue, Southeast, No. 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Call 1-888-699-6397, toll free and charge. Also available is a special one-hour audio interview with Victor Thorne, wherein he provides even more information on his research on the book. Victor Thorne, Exposing the NWO Assassins Audio Interview, $15 plus $3 shipping and handling, CD. Special offer, get the book and the CD as a combo for $40 plus $5 shipping and handling. You save a total of $5. Page 18, Tough Talk from Jim Traficant. What will happen when federal government collapses? By Jim Traficant. Republicans want to cut the budget, but Democrats say it's too much. The political machinations finally reach the apex as the federal government is about to close down. It's crunch time, folks. Unless some compromise can be reached, the government will have to shut down. Of course that did not happen. A deal was miraculously struck right before the government was set to shut its doors. The thing to keep in mind is that this drama is not new. It's a prelude of many more deadlines to come. Politicians, especially in Washington, D.C., often create some impasse that will attract attention. Then they demonstrate to the voters their effectiveness and ingenuity. These incidents are often milked for political gain, a sort of one-upmanship. The press covers the ordeal around the clock with talking heads analyzing any and every possible development. While all of this theater unfolds, the buzz phrase is government shutdown. Let's now analyze a soap opera. I can recall making a speech during a similar shutdown deadline some years ago. While nearly all the politicians were lamenting how terrible a shutdown would be for America, I said, "Shut it down. It's better for America to pass a good budget than opt for a bad budget simply to avert a shutdown." I also said, "Nobody will be hurt. All government payments will be made. In fact, it will turn into a paid vacation for government employees." I found it interesting to learn that television talk show host and commentator Robert Novak agreed with me. Novak, now deceased, was a true conservative, not one of these New World Order type pretenders. Congress acts too many times to avoid scrutiny rather than doing what's best for the country. In Washington, no politician will be a loser with whatever they pass. The losers, my friend, are we American taxpayers. How much more debt will be put on our backs? How many hundreds of billions? Will we soon start talking about adding trillions of dollars to the national debt? Tell me, if America disintegrates into independent states, similar to the reconfiguration of the old Soviet Union, who will pay those Social Security checks? Who will foot the bill for Medicare? When that moment presents itself, there will be no last-minute reprieves. It's likely that America will reconfigure into independent states or confederations of several states, which begin to function with little involvement in what was known as the Union. The great Civil War of 150 years ago will again raise its head, but this time, no bullets will be shot. There will be little or no uprising, just like the breakup of the Soviet Union. The big, powerful federal government will simply be dissolved. What happens when an individual or company can no longer function financially? Is government really above the mathematical rules of financial gravity? Our nation's infrastructure is in freefall. 27% of America's bridges need major repairs or replacement. But America is applying band-aids to try to get by because we do not have the money to take care of the country's essential business. So we avert another deadline with another feel-good compromise that mortgages our future. But no government shutdown once again. Get back at me. The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan, A Look at the Federal Reserve in the Era of Transparency by Vince Ryan. The next time you have a conversation with some friends about government finance and money, be sure to mention that the Federal Reserve is not federal, but private. Confidently and quickly add, if you will, that the Fed is no more federal than the federal laundry on Main Street. In Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, the powers of Congress are enumerated. Among them is the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. In December 1913, with many of its legislators on Christmas vacation, Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act, establishing the Federal Reserve Corporation, with a board of directors, the Federal Reserve Board, to run it. It also divided the United States into 12 Federal Reserve districts. From that point on, Congress was out of the picture. They abdicated their constitutional duty to coin money, and President Woodrow Wilson signed the legislation into law. Judge Andrew Napolitano, writing in his enlightening book, Lies the Government Told You, lists as lie number 8, the Federal Reserve shall be controlled by Congress. According to the judge, the federal government not only claimed it could exert control over a private corporation in which it was not even a stockholder, but also claimed that such an uncontrolled private corporation would be working for the benefit of the American people rather than to enrich itself. It was to be the lender of last resort that would keep all Americans prosperous. As absurd as they sound, these myths continue to be believed and perpetuated even today. The judge further charges that the word reserve is also a lie. A reserve implies, and many people believe, that money is being stored away to use in a crisis, and that gold and other hard money are stored in order to ensure that all debts can be paid. This is not the case. Though original notes issued by the Federal Reserve stated, this note is legal tender for all debts public and private, and is redeemable in lawful money at the United States Treasury or at any Federal Reserve Bank, this was changed by a 1963 amendment. The notes now read, this note is legal tender for debts public and private. By removing the promise and is redeemable in lawful money, the Federal Reserve, with the support of the federal government, eliminated a constitutional monetary system and replaced it with paper and public debt. Thomas Jefferson is believed to have said 200 years ago, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their money, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. Monetary expert Eustace Mullins, writing in his important book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, said, removal of the Federal Reserve System from congressional control and supervision made the entire Federal Reserve proposition unconstitutional from its inception, because the Federal Reserve would be a bank of monetary issue, and Congress is expressly charged in the Constitution with the issuance of money, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5. Today, Representative Ron Paul, Republican Texas, is leading the fight in Congress to abolish the private and unconstitutional Federal Reserve. He writes in his recent book, the day the Fed came into being in 1913 may have been the beginning of the end, but the powers it obtained and the mischief it caused took a long time to become a serious issue and a concern for average Americans. The Fed's inability to manage this unworkable system is more apparent every day. The question remains whether a new conspiracy on money and central banking can replace what we have, or will we choose a system of money compatible with free society? The answer will come from an informed and enraged populace. Congress will then respond, but only when it is impossible not to. Time is of the essence. Write your representative in Congress and tell him or her you want action now. Lies the Government Told You, 349 pages, hardcover, $28 plus $5 shipping and handling, by Judge Andrew Napolitano, is available from AFP's First Amendment Books, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Call us at 1-888-699-6397 toll-free to charge to Visa, MasterCard, Amex, or Discover.